The last time we got into this situation was in Anchorage, Alaska. And the Russians thought, and Sergey Lavrov said 2 days ago, that they had a good understanding between Putin and Trump at that meeting and how this could come to an end. Russia's never changed from that. They haven't changed now. They're not going to change. Trump didn't acknowledge that and weirdly said afterwards, I thought five times we had a deal. Well, the only way you would think you had a deal is if you agreed to the Russian terms, because they're not budging. So all the pomp and circumstance about Alaska came and went, nothing changed. Are we going to be in that situation this time? Because the same dynamics exist. Trump said he wants peace. He put something on the table. The Russians have apparently replied behind the scenes, and Witkoff is apparently going to go to Moscow next week to talk with Putin again, but he'll just repeat the same things he told Trump back in August. Will Trump then say, okay, to Europe and Ukraine, you guys don't want to play? I've done all I can. I can't stop you from committing national suicide. Have at it. We're not going to go down that path. Or will he do like he did after Alaska and just shrug his shoulders and just keep going as though nothing happened? In which case, just like in Alaska, all of this flurry of activity will just fade away as though it never happened. And we'll be right back where we were, say, in July of last summer, where we were a week ago before all this stuff bubbled to the surface. I mean, that's really where it is. It is in Trump's hands to either make something happen or just walk away and show that he is incapable and powerless to stop Zelensky or Mark Rutte or Ursula von der Leyen at all, because they're all running the show right now. You got to be honest, that's the case, because they're not budging either. So right now you have Europe and Ukraine not budging, Russia not budging, and the Americans trying to get anybody to budge and not having any success. I just don't see it any other way.
Well, the thing is, if we went back to the beginning of 2022, and at this point, there would have been a very different form of negotiation. And again, then at that time, the Russians only put Ukraine neutrality as a demand. But of course, after 3.5 years of fighting, almost four, yeah, things have changed. And now that advantage is fully in the Russian side, but also the war has changed fundamentally. That is, NATO has taken a very active role in this. So the Russians will have high demands, and then they're in position to demand it. So for this reason, as you said, they can compel compliance, but it doesn't appear to mean much in Europe. They still insist. I mean, if you've seen their proposals, which I know you have, they don't reflect this reality. They do this. The actual realities on the ground, they don't have any leverage. So how are they supposed to get Russia's signature on this deal? That is,
and Glenn, let me throw in one other thing at this point here, because I think it's important. In that you mentioned the conditions that existed in 2022, where this could have been negotiated away, etc. Because we chose not to do it either before February 24th or afterwards in Istanbul, and we had a chance for both. The Russia that existed at that time, they had somewhere around 200,000 troops that were designated to fight in Ukraine, but only initially for actually several weeks, if I understand correctly, barely 100,000 came in, which is not a fraction of enough to do anything in a whole country. And they had split out in five different axes. They were demonstrating, trying to show you can't win this war, so there's no reason to wage it, so end it. So that was the hope of the Russians. It was bad because they only had a plan A. They didn't have a plan B resourced, and they've been paying for it ever since. But now then, they did pay for it. And so now then, they have this military that is profoundly more strong than it was in 2022. And NATO is about where it was in 2022. Not only the experience and the capabilities and the doctrines they've learned and the way they've learned to fight and the drones, both at the strategic, operational, and tactical levels and all the different variations that go with that. But they also now have the Oreshnik missile. They have the Burevestnik, never-ending cruise missile, etc. These glide bombs now that they have, they didn't have those at all at the beginning, and now then they have a new iteration where they have almost double their range, etc. So making the Russian Air Force, they don't even have to go into harm's way. They can just fly with impunity in airspace that they fully control, and the Ukraine side is helpless. All those kind of things are in the Russians' favor, and their overall force is now 50% bigger than it was. It's 1.5 million or somewhere around there right now. and it was somewhere less than 1 million at the outbreak of war. So everything that we have done, all the dynamics that existed that we didn't have a negotiation in early 2022 are now profoundly worse for our side. And because of all these sanctions, we've made Russia less vulnerable to Western influence. So really, anywhere you want to calculate it, we have made ourselves comparatively weaker to the Russian side, which should mean we have all the more reason right now to have a negotiated settlement to get this off the table and stop that imbalance, which continues to go against us. But instead, we're acting like it's still, I don't know, 1991. It's hard for me to figure out.
Yeah, no, you have a good point, because not only have the Russians become much stronger, but they have essentially bled out the entire Ukrainian army. That is its equipment, its manpower, but also in 2022, NATO had the weapons storages, which were full. Now they're emptied. And lastly, the defensive lines. The Ukrainians had prepared defensive lines over the past 8 years. And now most of these are in the hands of the Russians. So all the advantage has been lost. And now, of course, we see the unraveling. And yet there is a insistence that any peace treaty has to be the capitulation of Russia, because it is the aggressor and the bad guy. This is the logic we get now. But what does this mean? What are you predicting I know we should be careful when we predict, but will this be resolved through diplomacy or on the battlefield?
Yeah, I mean, you can't predict, because human nature's things can change at a heartbeat. I mean, look at President Trump and how when the Mamdani was selected or elected to mayor of New York, at first he was like, this is a horrible person, he's a communist. And then all of a sudden there they are having a virtual love fest in the White House a little bit later. So Trump can change his mind pretty fast. Things can change. But we have to make an assessment based on where things are right now, where they've been going, and what the resources and the fundamentals say about where it can go. And here's the range of possibilities. Number one is this cannot go. Let's talk about what can't happen first. Ukraine can't win. Ukraine cannot stop Russia from winning. The period. I mean, years ago, I said Ukraine can't win. And then that changed over to Ukraine now cannot prevent loss, because Russia has the capacity and definitely the will to continue on. So that's the first point. So no matter where you want to start from, you have to start from the understanding that Ukraine will lose the war unless there's a negotiated settlement. And I mean, lose it militarily, where there's no negotiations. They don't get to have this. They don't get to press for that. They just get terms of surrender, or they're just destroyed, period. I mean, it's a full-on military victory. Russia has the capacity and the time and the patience to get that done. Now then, where we are here, if President Trump stands up and you know, girds up his loins, as they say, and just says, all right, I've made a decision that this is it. You guys get on board, or I'm out of here. And good luck to you losing this war, because that's what's going to happen. He could say that, and he could be open and honest about it. And then that's going to put this tremendous pressure on Europe to acknowledge they can't get this won, and that they can't succeed. And then they may say, all right, we're going to have an ugly negotiated deal, because there's no other alternative here. Or they're going to be faced with arrogance and presumption and hubris and say, oh, yeah, we can do it without you, America. It'll be harder, but we can still do it. Watch this. And then they themselves are ground to dust. And the Ukraine army is literally destroyed and obliterated. And all the manhood that the Ukraine is going to need to even have, even if there's a rump state left over to survive beyond, is going to be lost. And already they're at, I think it's 0.98 replacement capacity, which you need 2.1 just to be able to maintain your population going forward. They're at 0.98 right now. So they are dying as a nation as a result of all this. Congratulations, NATO. Congratulations, European Union. Well done on enabling the suicide of Ukraine, because that's what it's been so far. So that's the issue here. Will Trump stand firm and require this and then put the onus on Europe? Or will Trump do what he did in Alaska and just shrug his shoulders and move on and do nothing and make no point? That's what Europe is planning on. It's clear to me, especially with Mark Rutte's statements today, with Ursula von der Leyen, with Kaya Kallas' statements, and add Emmanuel Macron to that the day before, where he's talking about, you know, we have to have security guarantees and all this kind of thing. So all of these folks are still expecting Trump to just roll over again. That's what they're expecting. And if that happens, then Russia will just go, you leave us no choice then. we'd want to have an ugly negotiated settlement, according to how you might interpret it. But absent that, the only one is that we are still on and haven't slowed down. We'll simply keep marching west until we take everything that we want, and then we'll just tell you what the terms are at the end with no input from you. So that's where we are. And so you ask, which I think is the most likely. I think the most likely is that Trump rolls over and that Russia shrugs its shoulders and just continues marching west, and the Ukraine soldiers continue to die. And then, I don't know, I guess the Europeans are going to just say, well, we tried, and they'll blame it on everybody else in the world, and et cetera, and they'll just keep crying victimhood, et cetera. But it won't change the hardcore outcome. They can spin things all day long, but they are condemning Ukraine to death.
Yeah, no, it definitely seems that way. I do agree, though. It does look like the Europeans have, and Zelensky has made this decision that do not say no to Trump, you know, under any circumstance. Just say how wonderful his proposals are, how great the initiative is. He's a man of peace. And then at the same time, we just have to make some changes in the document, essentially reverse and any demands put on NATO and Ukraine.
And you know, by the way,
and hope that his fury will be directed to Russia.
What you say there is really important, and I want to piggyback off of it, is that you see these leaders in Europe, and Zelensky have really learned how to handle Trump. And so they praise him up one side and down the other, and they brag on him for all this, you know, these great things or whatever, while their actions subvert him and undermine him. And so they are continuing to go in a direction that can only lead to sabotage of these operations and this hope to get to peace. And you know, Trump seems to be unaware of it or unwilling to call them out on it.
I get the impression, though, that some people in Moscow are worried about what a premature end to the war could mean. Because I'm thinking about this article that Edward Luttwak, he wrote in 1999. It was called Give War a Chance. And he essentially argued that a lot of efforts to stop wars prematurely with ceasefire, peacekeeping, whatever it might be, it actually prolongs the wars rather than putting an end to it. Because usually war would come to an end when one side has decisively won. Yeah, so if, again, he didn't advocate for war, didn't say it was a good thing, but just that all of these efforts to stop it prematurely could extend it. And of course, on the European side, it looks like this is more or less by design, that is, stop the war now so he can't fight it later.
Although I would argue that concept, and there is some validity to the thought, though, but I think that have to apply from the side that's on the advantage. You don't want to stop your war too much. So that might be a message for Russia. Don't stop before you've achieved your attainable objectives. Otherwise, you could end up fighting it again. And you can certainly go back to World War I, World War II. You know, the end of one kind of helps set the stage for the other. There's some validity to that, but not from the losing side. Because if you're on the downside of that, you want the war off as fast as possible so that you might even have a chance to fighting another one later. Because if you don't get this one off the table now, you won't be around to fight another one. And that is where I think they're missing the boat.
Let me get in one final quick question. That is, you know, this war, as you said, it's largely about the European security architecture. That is, the efforts to create a Europe without the Russians, collective hegemony through NATO expansion. Now that this whole thing is blowing up, how do you see the European security architecture, the consequences of NATO's and Ukraine's defeat in this war on Russia?
You know, that's one of the most exasperating and tragedies of this whole war, in my view, is that there could have been a very effective European security architecture, which could have kept everybody safe in Europe, Western Europe, Central Europe, on the border with Russia, and Russia, Ukraine, Georgia. Everybody could have benefited from a good security architecture if everybody's security had been on the table. You mentioned at the outset of this very episode here how the Western side didn't even want to include Russia in anything. So they built into the system from the beginning a have and a have not, and an inside and an outside. So they almost made sure that even after we got the so-called Iron Curtain knocked down, that we quickly built a new one made of different material, but a division nevertheless. And then now here we have the problem where you had this weaker, you know, this defunct Russia after the end of the Soviet Union. And yay, we can keep them down there. But the problem is, they're not going to stay down, and they didn't, and they came back up. So now then we're in this position where we no longer, it's not 1991 anymore. We can't dictate anymore. We can't just ignore them anymore. So now either you're going to have to go back and have a security architecture that's now will not be to your advantage, but will at least be doable. Or we're just going to say, no, we'll have our war one way or the other. There's going to be conflict between Russia and the West. And, you know, it's inevitable. You see many countries in the West are already talking about this. They're already physically preparing for it. They say it all the time. And I think, you know, at this point, it's also important to point out that part of the nefarious forces in the West that want this are those that need an enemy. And they have chosen to keep Russia as the enemy. They did not want to and actively worked against a European-wide security architecture. They don't want continental-wide peace. They needed an enemy to focus on so that they could build up the defense industrial base, et cetera, which they have successfully done. And as long as you got a bad guy, you can keep everybody motivated to keep spending more money. Now we're up to allegedly on a path to 5% of GDP across the entire European Union, or at least across the entire West European NATO and all the countries, et cetera, guaranteeing that that will continue to go on. Now, I would imagine that they would, in their perfect world, stay just short of war, but where they keep spending money and they keep having an evil enemy over here to point to. But I don't know that they're going to have their perfect world. I think that they're going to have one of these situations where you basically get the thing that you wanted to avoid, which is a war. And this time it won't go like it did in World War II. I think we may end up being on the losing side of this one, if God forbid it goes nuclear, in which case everyone loses. But if it stayed conventional, we're right now on the lower end of this and we would lose.
No, I think that's exactly what the EU leadership would like to see, though. That is to put the Ukraine-Russia war on the slow burner, just to gradually, slowly deplete Russian resources while in the rear the Europeans build up. Instead, we got the opposite, where the Ukrainians were bled out, European economies were weakened while the Russians grew stronger. It's just sad, though, that, as you said, in the 1990s, we had the option of developing an inclusive security architecture based on indivisible security, where we also take into account Russian security. This has kind of been the lesson of history. This is how we create security. However, once we saw the opportunity to go for hegemonic peace, we complemented this with an ideology that is, we don't need to include Russia. We have inter-democratic security institutions, NATO, EU. You know, everyone benefits. They're a force for good. So even when NATO and Russia expanded towards Russian borders, the Russians should have been happy because this would bring stability. This was the argument. So we ran this massive social experiment, and now it's blown up in our face in a very horrible way, and there's no one who wants to hit the reverse. So
And you know, and ironically, Glenn, if we had of had that attitude but had not physically advanced NATO and had just stopped it where it was, that might have persisted. They might have been able to get away with that. But once we started, moving NATO further and further, and then demanding it go into Ukraine and Georgia in 2008, and then all the way up to 2022, continued to say this about NATO, and now say it continuing today by not taking it off the table. I mean, we just almost guarantee conflict.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming on and giving your insights.
Always my pleasure, Glenn. Thanks for having me.